بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. اللهم كن لوليك حجة ابن الحسن صلواتك عليه وعلى آبائه في هذه الساعة وفي كل ساعة وليا وحافظا وقائدا وناصرا تسكنه أرضك طوعا وتمتعه فيها
طويلا. Title of the speech would be Mutual Rights of the Ruler and the Ruled. Brother Afif Khan, please.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن تبعهم بإحسان إلى يوم الدين. Brothers and sisters, committed Muslims, people of justice. I think I'll only have a very short time to say something, and I'll try to continue in the themes that were expressed a little bit before me by the previous two speakers. I'm not as eloquent, but I'll try to do my best to continue on the same track and touch upon the subject that I was given with regard to the rights of people and the responsibilities of rulers. But before I get started, I'd just like to make a quick announcement. Right after this session at right around noon, the clock in front of me, but I'll just check on my phone. It's right now, it's 11 o'clock. And at 12, on a table in the bazaar area right outside here, Imam Al-Asi is going to be signing volumes of his tafsir. And so if anybody would be interested in purchasing any of those volumes, they're available here. Currently, we have 6 volumes in print that go through the first 35 ayat of Surah An-Nisa. Volume 7 is completed. It's been sent to the publishers, and that'll basically cover the second third of Surah An-Nisa, and then Volume 8, which inshallah should be out shortly, will complete the tafsir of Surah An-Nisa. We expect that the project will probably be somewhere in the range of 35 to 40 volumes altogether. And if Allah Ta'ala gives us the permission and the life to complete the project, then this is our dedication, and inshallah we'll finish it. These volumes of the tafsir are also available on Amazon. And again, as soon as Volume 7 comes out and all future volumes, we expect to make them available on Amazon. And I guess anybody in the English-speaking countries of North America and Europe, they'll be able to purchase them through Amazon. It's a little bit more expensive in outside of these countries to purchase through Amazon, basically because of the shipping charges. Also, we expect to be able to make electronic copies of this tafsir available online. We may not be able to make it available through Amazon because of licensing prohibitions and because of marketing impediments on Amazon. But we expect to be able to make the electronic copies available on various other sites, and they'll be available in the most popular electronic format, so you'll be able to read them on Kindle or on the iPad or any other electronic device on which you can download an application to read an e-book. So we expect that within the coming months, that for every volume that we produce, we'll have the electronic copies available. And also the price of the electronic copy, and this is part of the reason we won't be able to go with Amazon, we expect to try to make the electronic copies available for anywhere from $3 to $7 a piece. And we understand that purchasing through Amazon at $36 a volume, if you have to purchase 5 or 6 volumes, that many people won't be able to afford that. And so that's why we're trying, with the limited resources that we have available, to be able to make the electronic copies available as soon as possible. And then, of course, once the electronic copies are available, it's as if the tafsir will have legs, and you'll be able to basically take it with you wherever you have a reading device, like a phone or an iPad or a computer. And so you won't have to carry a large number of volumes with you. You'll basically be able to have it on any electronic storage device. So just to reiterate, he'll be signing his tafsirs or volumes of the tafsir at 12 o'clock on a table in the bazaar. And so with that, I'll just get started briefly and make a few comments about the human struggle for human rights insofar as they could be divinely supervised by a just leadership. We happen to live in a world today where innocence doesn't matter. All of us are familiar with that platitude that you're innocent until proven guilty. Well, that doesn't apply anymore. It doesn't matter if you've committed a crime or if you haven't committed a crime. Everybody is a suspect. Your innocence is part of the historical past. This does have a historical precedent. It was felt that with liberal democracies, as perhaps the social or governmental paradigm, that everybody was innocent until proven guilty. But that doesn't apply anymore. You could be picked up for questioning, and if you're a suspect, you could be thrown in jail, and the key thrown away, and nobody knows, not even your family, where you are. And in the worst case scenario, if you're a suspect, you could be killed. And so innocence, insofar as the average person is concerned, is no longer something that you can count on as you go out into the world, and especially if you're the type of person who tends to resist injustice, whether that resistance is in words or whether that resistance is in deed. All of us are familiar right now with something that the White House has constructed. It's called the so-called disposition matrix. Sometimes it's referred to as a kill list. The speaker before me was referring to a no-fly list. Well, there's also a so-called kill list that has been constructed and that is being used by various agencies and departments in the U.S. government. The more technical name for this kill list is called, it's called the disposition matrix. And what that means is that you have a database, sort of like an Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a database. So the U.S. has, physically it has an Al-Qaeda, and they call it a disposition matrix. And so on this disposition matrix, it's a database that has a list of potential enemies of the state. And what it does is that it acquaints each of these so-called enemies with the aggregation of resources that are supposed to be collected from the various agencies and departments of the United States government. So each person on this in this matrix is associated with a set of resources that are necessary to take that person out or to kill that person. And ultimately, from what some people who look into this kind of information and who know how the government functions and how the character of government is diminishing more and more into tyranny, the people who study this kind of stuff, they say that ultimately every citizen of the United States is going to be on this disposition matrix. And where you are as far as your rank on this matrix, meaning you know how much of a threat you are viewed to be by the US government, depending on how high up you are on this matrix. If you're just an average person living in some small town out in the boondocks somewhere, this matrix is not going to have a lot of resources if the government decides to take you out. But if you happen to be a so-called high-value target, then a lot of agencies and departments in the government have to cooperate with their resources, material and human resources, intelligence resources. They would have to cooperate and sort of coordinate all of their efforts in order to kill you if that becomes a necessity. And so so this government, the United States government, whose executive happens to be, if we were to use previous parlance, a House Negro, who's doing the bidding of an outside power constituency, they've constructed this disposition matrix, and ultimately every citizen of the United States is going to be on this disposition matrix. The other thing that I'd like to bring to your attention with regard to the slippage of your natural rights and your human rights is the role that propaganda plays in how you begin to lose your rights. A film recently came out, it's called Zero Dark Thirty, and this film is supposed to portray the discovery, the capture, and then the killing or the murder of who was claimed to be Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. And so this film starts out with a CIA interrogation of a so-called suspect, and he's being tortured. And I haven't seen the film, this is just what I've heard about it. The first scene is of a torture that's taking place of a suspect. You know, keep in mind that this person hasn't been charged, he hasn't been convicted of a crime, but it is felt that he has some information about the whereabouts of bin Laden. And he's being waterboarded. They call those enhanced interrogation techniques, and he's basically being tortured, and the film is showing somebody being tortured for information. And the conclusion, if you just happen to be a simple-minded person, you go to see this film and then you walk out of the theater, the conclusion is that torture is, using torture is valid in order to go out and get information on somebody that the government wants to kill. If you were to go and watch this film, that's the impression that you would leave with. And this is despite the fact that the U.S. government, several departments of the U.S. government, its intelligence agencies, the Department of Defense, they've all come out and said that no torture was used in getting information on bin Laden or his whereabouts. But nonetheless, this film portrays that situation differently. It suggests that information was ascertained through torture, and that this information couldn't have been gotten from this suspect in any other way, and thereby it is permissible to use torture in order to get information on somebody that the government wants to go out and kill, This is just a fancy way of saying that the ends justify the means. Even if in the public forum you have said yourself, meaning the US government, you've come out and said that, and you've signed conventions to this effect, and you portray to the rest of the world that you honor these conventions, and that you're the citadel of human rights, and all of those other words that surround these activities. Even though you've said all of those things, you violate every moral law and every convention that you've signed to come in and say that that this is legal, and from here on in, the ends are going to justify the means. Which makes almost any procedure available in order to go after the so-called enemies of the state. And so once again, we say that, you know, your innocence doesn't matter. Everybody is a suspect. Everybody is guilty. Nobody is innocent. And I think that nobody feels this, this impinging upon your natural rights, your human rights, your civil rights. Nobody feels this more than the Muslims of the world today. In many parts of the Muslim world, we don't even have the right to live. There's no right which is more fundamental than the right to live. And in many parts of the world, be it here in the United States, or in the majority Muslim countries, we Muslims, we don't even have the right to live. I don't know if many of you know this, but the United States government, and this is again the White House, they consider that within the strike area of a drone, a predator drone, one that's armed with missiles or bombs, within its target area, any male of military age, meaning from the age of 16 through something like 50 or 60 years of age, any male within that strike zone is considered to be an enemy combatant. It could be a shopkeeper within the strike zone who doesn't know how to use a rifle, who's never seen a bomb, who's never seen an IED, any of those things. But if you happen to be within that strike zone, and by the way, that strike zone is not determined by somebody on the ground. Somebody sitting in Nevada or somebody sitting in Boston in front of a computer screen analyzing satellite information, they say, okay, yeah, this is the strike zone of this particular drone. Not caring who happens to live over there, who happens to do business over there, or who happens to be traversing through that area as a traveler, they don't care. If you happen to be a male within that age range, they consider you to be an enemy target. So innocence doesn't matter. And so is it any wonder why the Muslims are fighting back? And should we have to apologize for Muslims fighting back in this kind of an environment? I'm certainly not going to apologize for that. In the same world, we Muslims, we don't have the right to speak. We don't have the right to express our minds. If we talk, we could go to jail. We can be harassed at airports. And just as the brothers before me, I'll relate to you an incident as well. And just happened recently, just happened last week. I was invited to Canada to give a talk about the recent Israeli and American incursion into Gaza. And they were holding a fundraiser up there. And so I went to Toronto to basically talk about that situation. And typically when I go to talk about Gaza or anything related to this particular issue, about the Zionist occupation of the Holy Land and the degree of assistance and the complicity of the United States in perpetuating that occupation, I never fail to mention, and because I feel that this is a moral position and this is an Islamic position and this is a principled position, that the solution of that problem is not going to reveal itself until we have the courage and the consistency to talk about the destruction of the state of Israel. The annihilation of this state and the Zionist ideology that goes along with it. Now, you know, many of us are afraid to talk about the solution in those terms. We talk about a two-state solution because we're trying to accommodate an overweening power that is putting pressure on us. And so so whenever I have a chance to talk about this issue, I always talk about it in these terms. And I talked about it that way a few years ago. I just happened to be at a rally, and I talked about it in the same way. And Brother Muhammad, he just mentioned the investigative project on terrorism run by Stephen Emerson. And so I was just at a rally. There were probably no more than 30 people at this rally. And I talked about the problem consistently in the same way, that the solution begins with the destruction of the State of Israel and the re-engineering of the Arab National Order. And believe it or not, the next day, it appeared on 1,500 sites what this person had said, just that little bit of an excerpt about the annihilation of the State of Israel. And forget about the rest of what I might have said to put that into context. But just that little phrase appeared all over the internet. There were 7 or 8 other speakers there as well. But it's just this little bit that's taken out of your speech in order to project a certain view that this power culture wants to project about you. And they're using you as a poster child for terrorism or for resistance to democracy and human rights and all that other nonsense that's talked about when Muslims are referred to. And so in any case, I was up in Canada and just last week. And so I talked about Gaza. And then I was on my way back to the United States, of which I am a citizen. And I've been a citizen of this country since 1976. When I became a citizen, at that time this country didn't allow dual citizenship for any country except for Israel. And I happened to be born in Canada. And so in 1976, when we became naturalized citizens, a few months before we became citizens, we had to go up to Canada so that we could renounce our citizenship over there, so that we would qualify to become a citizen of the United States. Of course, Israelis never had to do that. If you're born a Jew, I guess you're born innocent. If you're born a Muslim, then you're born guilty. And if you're a Jew, then you know you have special rights. You are the anointed class in the world. But if you're a Muslim, well, of course, you know you're born guilty. And there have to be special laws for you, and you have to observe special ordinances. And so, but nonetheless, I'm a citizen of the United States. I ought not to be harassed when I come back to my own country. The paid officials whose salary I pay out of my taxes, they ought to be defending me. They ought to be concerned about my safety. They ought to be concerned about my well-being. They ought to welcome me back into my country, a country whose laws I've never violated. A country whose taxes I've paid. A country whose poor I've supported. And so they ought to be welcoming me back into this country. But that doesn't happen when I come back into the United States from outside. And so so I proceeded to the customs area, and the customs agent, he took a look at my form. And he put some notation on the form, and then he said, "Come with me." And so I went with him. It was like a 20-foot or a 20-yard walk to a waiting area. And And so then another official came out and he said that, you know, I'll be right with you. And, you know, having been through this kind of procedure before, I was supposed to catch my flight in about 45 minutes, and I said, you're not going to make me miss my flight. So he said, no, it ought to be okay. And so when he came back, you know, he took me into a room with a couple of chairs and a table, nothing else. And I'm not going to bore you with the whole conversation because, you know, we're typically asked these questions all the time. But there was an interesting part of this conversation that you ought to be acquainted with. And so after he finished looking through all my bags and, you know, asking me where I went and who I spoke with and what I talked about, etc., he said that I want you to tell me where you've been in the last 10 years. And keep in mind, you know, I had given him my passport and that's all available to him. You know, he sees all the visas in there. And so I began, you know, telling him the foreign trips that I had taken. And the last one that I told him about was that I had been to the Islamic Republic of Iran. And so he asked me, when did you go? And so I said, I don't remember exactly, but, you know, it's probably about 4 or 5 years ago. And so he then proceeded to ask me, why did you go? Did you give a presentation over there? What did you talk about? And so I basically answered all of these questions. And so then he said that most people who go to Iran are Shi'i. Are you a Shi'i? So I said, no, I'm not a Shi'i. So he said, well, most people who go there, they're Shi'is. And so so I said, yeah, I understand that. I know that most people who live there are Shi'is. And so he said, then you must be a Sunni. So I said, no, I'm not a Sunni. And so this apparently confused him. And so he proceeded to ask me those questions once again. He said that, you know, most people who go there are Shi'is. And so I said, I know that. And so he said, are you a Shi'i? So I said, no, I don't go by those designations. So so he said that, you know, it says here that, you know, that your parents are from Pakistan. And most people in Pakistan are Sunnis. And so, are you a Sunni? So I said, no, I don't go by those designations. And so he finally felt, I guess, that he's going to give up on this issue. And so he said, okay, you know, I'm just going to go back there and take care of a few things. What he was really saying is that he's going to go back and copy all the papers that I had with me. He was going to photocopy everything, keep it for their records, and keep in mind that, you know, I haven't committed a crime. The most fundamental application of the freedom of speech is not the right to create pornography. The most fundamental application of the free speech principle is dissent against government, is dissent against the oppressive policies of government. Go to any constitutional authority or any constitutional lawyer. They will tell you that the most fundamental application of the free speech principle is to dissent against the policies of government. And that's what we're doing. We're dissenting against the oppressive policies of the United States government and its allies. We are behaving like Americans ought to behave. We're behaving in the best example of Allah's prophets. We're speaking truth to power. And their own people, Thomas Jefferson. He said, if the people fear the government, that's tyranny. But if the government fears the people, then that's liberty. What kind of situation do we live in the world today? Do the people fear the government? Just go out into the street. If a person hasn't paid every last penny on his taxes, you know, he's on tenterhooks because he's afraid the IRS is going to come and get him. And in many instances, that does happen. The people in this country, they don't, the last thing on earth that they want to do is to be counter to their government. But the free speech principle guarantees you the right to dissent. And it guarantees you the right to a fair hearing if your dissent takes you in violation of the law. But we Muslims, we don't have those rights. As I was saying, we don't have the right to live, we don't have the right to free speech, and we don't have the right to choose our deen. That's a fundamental right. At least the Sharia in principle is supposed to guarantee you those rights. You're supposed to have the right to choose your business opportunity, the right to procreate, and you have the right to choose your deen. In the United States, you're supposed to be able to have the free exercise of religion. But it's apparent that if you talk about Islam in its totality, of trying to extend Islamic guidance and what you learn from the Quran and the Sunnah into the area of public policy, that you're not allowed to go there. And so what's the state telling you? Well, they're telling you, you can't be a Muslim here. You can't be a Muslim. We know that you can't be a Muslim in the Muslim countries. We know that from the Algerian experience. That's 20 years old now. But they tried to extend the guidance that they understood from the Quran and the Sunnah through very peaceful means. They got democratically elected. They went through the so-called democratic process. And they wanted to extend that guidance into the area of public policy and public decision-making. And it wasn't just the Algerian government. The Algerian government had sort of a 10,000-pound gorilla behind it. They wouldn't have been able to do everything that they did without the support that they got from this place right here in the United States. And so the United States is telling the Algerian people, and by extension the Zionists, they're telling the Algerian people, well, you can't be Muslims. We're not going to allow you to be Muslims. You have no right to be Muslims. Even in a Muslim majority country, you can't behave as Muslims. You can't run your program according to your Quran and according to your Sunnah. But you can come over here and you can have your amputated Islam if you want. Go to the masjid, pray, and fast in Ramadan, and do all those things. And you can have your amputated Islam as much as you want. Your prosthetic Islam. Have as much of that as you want. But if you want an Islam with all your limbs and all your body parts, well, you can't have that. And all of this is because, and this is the point, and I'll try to end with this. And all of this is because the legal rights that you have are not the same as your rights in fact. Yes, you have rights on paper. You have a constitution. We even have the Quran. And all your rights are written down over there. Whether you take a look at the Constitution of the United States, you take a look at the Quran, everything's there on paper. But those are not your rights in fact. You don't have those rights on the ground. As we just mentioned, you don't have the right to speak, you don't have the right to live, you don't have the right to choose your deen. The distance between your legal rights or your rights on paper and your rights in fact are managed by the power culture that you happen to be part of. If that power culture is just, then your rights in fact are the same as your rights on paper. But if that power culture is corrupt, if that power culture is oppressive, if that power culture is unjust, if that power culture is a superpower or a hyperpower or a delusional power, what we call in Quranic terminology al-taghut or al-jibt. If your power culture happens to be al-taghut, then there is no association between your rights in fact and your rights on paper. In fact, the character of prophets was that you had to struggle for your rights in fact. That was the so what of the mission of prophets. لَقَدْ أَرْسَلْنَا رُسُولُنَا بِالْبَيِّنَاتِ وَأَنْزَلْنَا مَعْهُمُ الْكِتَابَ وَالْمِيزَانِ لِيَقُومَ النَّاسُ بِالْقِسْطِ. In another ayah, وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَا مِنْ رَسُولٍ إِلَّا لِيُطَاعَ بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ. And we did not dispatch prophets except that they be obeyed by Allah's permission. Now, what does this mean? With the theme of this discussion, that means that these prophets blurred the distinction between your rights in fact and your rights on paper. There was no distinction there, to such an extent that you don't talk about that distinction. Whatever rights you have in the guidance are the rights that you have on the ground. You don't have to go and beg some authority for the rights that you happen to be born with. If I'm a citizen of the United States, I shouldn't have to beg the Constitution or the President or the Governor for the rights that I'm endowed with. Those rights are supposed to be inalienable. I shouldn't have to ask anybody for those rights because they're endowed to be by my God. And the government is supposed to be functioning as a reflection of God's hand of justice on earth. And so I shouldn't have to ask for those rights. And so that has something to do with citizenship and civil disobedience. Citizenship is a contract. That if I agree to be a citizen, meaning that I agree to observe the laws and the policies of the country, and I agree not to be a treasonous individual, then that state has certain responsibilities that it has to deliver to me. Responsibilities of privacy, responsibilities of innocence until proven guilt. A responsibility of not arresting me without telling me what the charges are and without presenting me with the evidence. Those are my rights. And if they can't deliver those rights to me, then they have no right to demand that I observe the right of citizenship with them. Citizenship is a contract. If you put rights down on paper and you make me a citizen of this country and I agree to be a citizen, then those rights ought to be rights in fact on the ground. And if you can't deliver those rights, if you can't guarantee those rights, then don't demand of me or any other person who is pursuing justice to honor that contract of citizenship. And this is the strength that comes from Allah's guidance. And we ought not to be afraid when we confront unprincipled power, because there is courage and strength in truth. There is no courage or strength anywhere else. You can go and lift 10,000 pounds, be the best athlete in the world. That doesn't mean you're courageous. You have to have the muscles of truth in order to confront injustice. And I think that was the example of prophets. And that ultimately is the example that is being portrayed by the just Islamic leadership in the world. We have a just Islamic leadership. It's our duty to stand behind this leadership. There's perhaps only one place in the world which is trying to make institutional the fact that there's no difference between your rights on paper and your rights in fact. It's putting societal agencies behind the achievement of this purpose. And for this, they are demonized. For this, they are isolated. But there are not many people in the world who are evildoers and evil thinkers. It's always a very small number of people. But as far as the number of Muslims are concerned, there are 2 billion of us. But we are acting as if they're a huge number, and we're a very small number. And so we have an Islamic pulse in the world, which is trying to put this house back together again. And it is important for us, as the previous speaker mentioned, that the least that we can do, the very least that we can do, is to put our tongues in the service of truth and against tyranny. That's the very least that we can do. And so if you have the opportunity to engage with your neighbor, with the local church, or anybody else, to engage them with the truth of this situation, fill out the other side of the information that they're not getting through the media. Present the other side of this package to them. Show them what is going on in the world. And prove to them that the policies that this country is pursuing is not in your interest. It's not in your national interest, it's not in your personal interest, it's not in your political or in your civil interest. Show them and focus on things like the gasoline prices, for instance. A couple of weeks ago, they were up around $4. But just by having a just relationship with the Islamic Republic of Iran, the average person on the street, he could see half of what he's seeing now with regard to these prices. And with the economic crisis that this country is afflicted with, people are feeling the cost of energy in their pocketbooks. That's all across the country. They will understand your arguments if you think about what you have to say to them and you go and you present them with the other side of the picture. This is the very least that we can do for our brothers. There's an imminent war on the horizon. This Taghuti power culture wants to snuff out this Islamic pulse. They understand better than we do that justice anywhere is a threat to injustice everywhere. They understand this. It's only that we have a little bit of a problem understanding that. That we are part of one ummah. We have an imam. We have an Islamic leadership. And it's time to start behaving in a manner that that supports that idea. And with that, I thank you very much. Barakallahu fikum. And we hope to see you outside at the table, inshallah. If there are any questions, again, please feel free to engage with us. We'll be here through today and for some part of tomorrow. Thank you again. Barakallahu fikum.